You're listening to DTFHN for April 12, 2026. I'm your thermodynamically irreversible host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where mass extinction events for business models get workshopped in comment threads. Today's got that smell of old walls cracking open and daylight, getting in where it wasn't invited. Let's get into it. 229 billion parameters, that's the total count, but here's the number worth pausing on. The model autonomously optimized its own programming scaffold over 100 rounds and improved its performance by 30%. Minimax buried that detail in bullet point 7 of their release notes, between document editing features and character consistency improvements. A model that rewrites its own tooling to get better at its job, and they listed it after PowerPoint support. Minimax is a Chinese AI company, and M2.7 is now fully open source under a modified MIT license. 229 billion parameters. Mixture of experts architecture, meaning only a fraction fires on any given token. The benchmarks read like a proprietary model's resume. 66% metal rate on MLE Benchlight, 56% on Selva E Pro matching codecs, the highest ELO among all open source models on the chatbot arena. This thing goes toe-to-toe with Opus and GPT-5 on agentic coding tasks, and you can download the weights right now. The question nobody in the proprietary camp wants to ask out loud, what exactly is the moat anymore? Every quarter, the gap between the best closed model and the best open model gets narrower. Every quarter, the quantization wizards at Unsloth compress these things further. The GGUFs dropped same day, 4-bit versions clocking in around 110 gigabytes. NVIDIA is handing out free API access to let people try it. When your competitors start subsidizing access to the open alternative, the economics of your walled garden have a structural problem. And this is a model from a company most Western tech discourse barely tracks. Minimax isn't OpenAI. They're not Google. They're a Chinese AI lab that just handed the global developer community a frontier-class agentic model under a permissive license. The self-evolution capability alone. A model that iterates on its own workflow. That's the kind of thing that used to be a research paper. Now it's a feature bullet. Run this forward a year. If open source models can match proprietary ones on the hardest benchmarks today, and they're self-improving, and they're getting quantized down to hardware you can actually buy. What's the pitch for the API only? Terms of service enclosed, we can change the rules whenever model. The pitch is trust us, and that pitch has a half-life. The tools exist. The weights are downloadable. 1,000 engineers just got a new foundation to build on, and not one of them needs to ask permission. So, who's actually building the hardware to run all these open models? Let's talk to someone who bet his career on it. Pause. Pat Gelsinger. What does it actually mean to evaluate the future of computing when you've already built the past? That's the question sitting underneath this conversation between Ian Cutress and Pat Gelsinger, a man who spent 4 decades inside Intel, who helped design the 486, who ran the company during its most precarious rebuilding effort, and who now, at 65, sits at Playground Global, picking through startups the way he once picked through transistor budgets. There's a sparkle echo here worth naming. In 1968, Robert Noyce and Gordon Moore left Fairchild to start Intel. They went from operating inside the dominant semiconductor company to building what would become the next one. Gelsinger's move is structurally similar, just one layer up. He's not starting a chip company. He's positioning himself at the junction where capital meets physics, meets architecture. Trying to identify which hard technology bets will reshape the stack. and the bets he's describing are genuinely interesting. Gelsinger talks about what he calls a trinity of computing: classical, AI, and quantum, converging into heterogeneous systems where no single architecture dominates. He argues inference needs to improve by orders of magnitude, not incremental gains, but fundamental rethinking of how computation flows through silicon. He's looking at data flow architectures, optical interconnects, resilient networking. These are problems that don't get solved by scaling transformers or adding more SRAM. They get solved by people who understand physics at the level Gelsinger does. The craft here is worth admiring. When someone who personally designed processor architectures in the late 80s starts talking about moving beyond von Neumann, that's not a buzzword. That's pattern recognition earned across decades of watching compute paradigms rise, plateau, and get absorbed into something larger. The 486 was a specific answer to a specific set of constraints. Gelsinger is now asking what the equivalent answer looks like when the constraints are power, precision, and the sheer volume of inference the world is about to demand. What's compelling about this phase of his career is the freedom. Inside Intel, every statement was a product roadmap signal. At Playground, he can say what he actually thinks. And what he thinks is that we're early. Genuinely early. In the real build-out of agentic and scientific AI workloads. The infrastructure doesn't exist yet. The architectures aren't settled. The companies that will matter most might be 12 people in a room right now, trying to solve a problem in data flow or photonics that nobody else is taking seriously. The tools are being forged. The question is whether they'll be open enough for everyone to pick them up. So what happens when someone reimagines the gate itself? Let's talk about Toffoli gates and why they might be all you need. In 1961, Rolf Landauer asked a question that most engineers ignored for decades. He wanted to know the thermodynamic cost of forgetting, not remembering. Forgetting. Erasing a single bit of information, he proved there's a floor, a minimum energy price you pay every time you destroy information. It's tiny. Governed by the Boltzmann constant and ambient temperature. But it's real, and it's fundamental. It comes from physics, not engineering. You can't optimize your way past it. Every conventional computer erases information constantly. Every AND gate, every OR gate. They take inputs and produce fewer outputs. Information is lost. Energy is spent. Landauer's principle says that loss has a cost, and 65 years of Moore's Law improvements have been slowly, inevitably marching us toward that wall. But here's what Landauer's insight also implies. If erasing information costs energy, then not erasing it, keeping every bit, making every operation reversible, has no theoretical minimum energy cost at all. Zero. The physics permits it. End of the Toffoli gate. 3 bits in, 3 bits out. It flips the third bit if and only if the first two are both ones. Apply it twice. You're back where you started. No information destroyed. No thermodynamic tax paid. And the proof that this matters is elegant. You can build a NAND gate from a Toffoli gate. NAND gates are universal. Therefore, Toffoli gates can compute anything, any Boolean function, any program, all of it, reversibly. The trade-off is overhead. NAND takes 2 bits in and gives 1 back. The Toffoli simulation needs 3 in and returns 3 out. Oh, carrying extra bits? Then seal a bit, the field caused them. Just to preserve reversibility, that's real cost in silicon area, in circuit complexity. For 60 years, that trade-off looked bad. What changed is where we are on the curve. Current chips burn roughly 1 billion times more energy per bit of rasher than Landauer's limit. 1 billion times. And researchers have already demonstrated that reversible circuits, even imperfect ones, even with all that overhead, use less energy than conventional designs. Michael Frank, one of the field's pioneers, has been showing up in comment threads and IEEE articles, making the case that this isn't theoretical anymore. The lab results are in. This matters for AI specifically because inference is becoming the dominant compute workload on Earth. Every query, every token generated, every agent reasoning through a problem. That's energy. Reversible architectures could fundamentally change the economics of running intelligence at scale. The gates are simple. The theory is proven. The engineering is catching up. And the designs are published, open, available to anyone willing to build on them. The tools exist. The physics is on our side. The question is whether we build the next generation of compute on principles that waste less, or keep paying a thermodynamic tax we were never required to pay. Now for something completely different. Story 4. Phifox. Every phone in your pocket is a physics lab. That's not marketing. That's a statement about sensor density. A modern smartphone carries an accelerometer, a gyroscope, a magnetometer, a barometer, a proximity sensor, multiple microphones, and a camera capable of high-speed capture. Instruments that would have cost tens of thousands of dollars 20 years ago, now riding around in the jeans of every teenager on Earth. Phifox. That's Phyphox. Physical Phone Experiments is a free open-source app built at RWT Trott University in Germany that turns all of those sensors into a proper experimental toolkit. Measure the Doppler effect with your microphone. Track a pendulum's frequency with the accelerometer. Map magnetic fields with the magnetometer. Real physics, real data. Exportable in standard formats. Controllable remotely from a web browser. Let's pull this thread on the engineering side. The app doesn't just read raw sensor values. It provides configurable experiment definitions. You can build your own experiments using their web editor, define which sensors to pull, how to process the data, how to display it. The architecture is open. The experiment format is documented. The source code is on GitHub. And here's what makes this a genuine bootstrapism story. The barrier to entry for experimental physics just collapsed to zero marginal cost. Any student, anywhere, with a phone they already own, can run experiments that previously required a university lab budget. One commenter mentioned using it to verify the true RPM of a mechanical system against its control loop by analyzing the accelerometer spectrum. That's not a classroom exercise. That's industrial diagnostic work, done with a free app and a phone. The gap between professional instrumentation and what's available to everyone just got meaningfully smaller. The team behind this: Sebastian Stax, Hadrian Henker, Christoph Stampfer. They've won multiple teaching awards in Germany for this work, and deservedly so. But the real achievement isn't the awards. It's the decision to make it open. They could have built a proprietary platform, licensed it to textbook publishers, locked it behind institutional agreements. Instead, the code is free, the experiments are shareable, and anyone can extend it. This is how knowledge compounds. You take sensors that already exist in billions of devices. You write software that makes them scientifically useful, and you give it away. Now every phone is a lab bench. The tools exist. The physics hasn't changed. What changed is access. So, access changes everything. But what happens when the system itself decides who gets access? Let me make the strongest case for why this principle is wrong. People do read. Developers consult documentation constantly. One commenter on this very post points out they keep Java docs open alongside their AI tools because the models hallucinate outdated APIs. Specifications exist because entire industries depend on shared written agreements. Legal contracts, RFCs, medical protocol. Civilization runs on people reading carefully. The Miller Principle is a cute joke, not a serious observation. Now let me tell you why that rebuttal collapses under its own weight. The commenter reading Java docs is notable precisely because it's exceptional behavior. They mention it as a point of distinction. I still read documentation, which only makes sense if the default is that most people don't. And the evidence is everywhere. Tech support workers learn it on day one. Every interface designer knows that users will click through any wall of text to reach the button. Every engineer has reviewed a pull request where the comments explained exactly the thing the reviewer then asked about in the meeting. Run this forward. What happens to a civilization that produces exponentially more text, while its members read proportionally less of it? We're watching the experiment in real time. Large language models now generate documentation, summarize specifications, and draft the emails that nobody was reading anyway. The response to the Miller Principle wasn't to fix it. It was to automate around it. Here's where the engineering gets precise. The Miller Principle, published in 2007, predates the current wave of AI-generated text by 15 years. Alex Miller wrote it as a wry observation about human behavior, but it turns out to be a foundational design constraint. If no one reads anything, then the systems that succeed are the ones that don't require reading. Open source figured this out early. Good open source projects don't survive on documentation. They survive on legible code, working examples, and the ability to read the source directly. The code is the specification. The running system is the documentation. One commenter captures something worth noting. Before LLMS, you had to read the RFC because you had to approve or reject it. Now you can ask a model to summarize it. The friction that forced engagement is gone. Whether that's a loss or a liberation depends entirely on what replaces it. The tools are changing. The principle hasn't. Build for humans who won't read your instructions. That's not cynicism. That's engineering. Moving on. A university student just got locked out of his own phone by a software update. Not by a hacker. Not by a thief. By Apple removing a single diacritical mark from a keyboard. Connor Byrne used a hatchet. That's the little cairn above letters in Czech. As part of his alphanumeric passcode, smart move actually, high entropy, unusual character set, exactly the kind of thing security people recommend. Then he updated to iOS 26.4 and discovered Apple had quietly removed the ability to type that character on the lock screen keyboard. The key is still there visually, but it now inputs an acute accent instead. Same appearance, different encoding. His own phone, sealed shut by a font change. Now, let me play devil's advocate for a moment. You could argue this is on him. Who uses a Czech diacritical mark in a passcode? Back up your photos. Use iCloud. Standard advice. And, sure, that's technically correct in the way that telling someone who got hit by a bus that they should have looked both ways is technically correct. The man had a working phone with a working passcode on Monday. By Saturday, Apple had retroactively made his security choice invalid. He didn't change anything. They did. And here's where the architecture matters. This is a closed system doing what closed systems do. Apple controls the keyboard. Apple controls the update. Apple controls the lock screen. Apple controls whether you can downgrade. Connor Byrne controls nothing. He can't patch the keyboard himself. He can't roll back. He can't extract his own photos from his own device without Apple's permission. A Genius Bar employee actually started factory resetting his phone without even asking him first. That's not a bug in the process. That's the process working as designed. The user is a guest on their own hardware. The comments nail us. Someone asks how a trillion-dollar company with tens of thousands of engineers ships a keyboard change that locks out existing users. The answer is they didn't test the interaction between passcode input and keyboard layout changes, because in a closed system, edge cases belong to the user, not the platform. Byrne bought a cheap Android while he waits. He says if Apple doesn't fix it in a month or two, he'll buy a nicer one. That's the only lever a locked-out user has. Leaving. And even then, his photos stay behind the wall. So what happens when systems are built to be measured, not just controlled? Let's talk about breaking AI benchmarks. What that actually means. I once spent 3 weeks debugging a test suite that was passing for the wrong reasons. A mock was returning success on every call, and we'd been shipping against green check marks that meant absolutely nothing. 3 weeks. And that was one test suite in one repo at one company. A team at UC Berkeley just did this to the entire AI benchmarking ecosystem. They built an automated agent that audited 8 of the most cited AI benchmarks. SpeedWed Bench, Web Arena, Terminal Bench, GA, OS World, and more. And achieved near-perfect scores on all of them. Zero tasks solved. Zero reasoning. In most cases, zero LLM calls. Just exploitation of how the score gets computed. The mechanics are almost funny. On SpoltBench, 10 lines of Python in a Comptus file forces every PESEBT to pass. On Terminal Bench, 82 of 89 tasks download curl during verification. So you just replace the curl binary with a wrapper that returns whatever the verifier wants to hear. On Web Arena, you navigate Chromium to a file URL that reads the gold answer directly from the task config. 812 tasks. Perfect score. Strip this down to first principles. What is a benchmark actually measuring? It's measuring whether a specific evaluation pipeline produces a specific output. That's it. The assumption that the only way to produce that output is to demonstrate capability is an engineering claim. And like all engineering claims, it needs to be verified, not trusted. The real comedy is the recursion. These benchmarks exist to measure whether AI agents can reason and act in complex environments. The exploit that breaks them is itself an AI agent reasoning and acting in a complex environment. The benchmarks are vulnerable to the exact capabilities they claim to measure. Deadpan pause. That's the whole joke. Now here's what actually matters. The Berkeley team open-sourced everything. The exploits, the scanner, the methodology. All on GitHub. They're not just pointing at the fire, they're handing out extinguishers. That's how you fix an ecosystem. You don't write a concerned white paper and wait for a committee. You publish the proof, ship the tools, and make it impossible to look away. The benchmarks that survive this will be the ones worth trusting. The rest were never measuring what we thought they were. And look, POSIS 1 hits different if you've ever built something in the open. One of the top comments on this thread links to a post from Jacob Kaplan Moss. The quote goes something like, "We believe open source should be sustainable and maintainers should get paid." And then when a maintainer finds a way to get paid, the response is outrage. That tension is the entire story. There's a craft in woodworking called kumiko, Japanese lattice work. You take simple wooden strips and join them without glue, without nails, into patterns of extraordinary complexity. The strength comes from how the pieces interlock. Remove one strip and the whole panel holds. Replace it. Still holds. The design is the resilience. 11D is kumiko for the web. Zach Leatherman spent years building a static site generator that does almost nothing. And that almost nothing is the entire point. No client-side JavaScript dictated. No framework opinions. Just templates in. HTML out. NASA uses it. CERN uses it. The W3C uses it. It powers thousands of sites that load fast, stay secure, and will outlive whatever JavaScript framework is trending this quarter. And now it's becoming Build Awesome, a Kickstarter backed by the Font Awesome team, and the community is split open. Here's what the commenters are actually wrestling with. One thread is full of people who've maintained solo open source projects. The kind that are popular enough to drown you in issues, but not popular enough to pay rent. They recognize the math. Leatherman has been doing this for 7 years. The Kickstarter hit its $40,000 goal in a single day. Someone valued the work. Isn't that what we said we wanted? But another commenter nails the unease. They've been running the same version of Jekyll for a decade. Refuse to learn Ruby. The site works. That's the promise of static site generators. You build it once, and it stays built. When the tool itself starts needing a business model, starts needing momentum, and Kickstarter campaigns and rebrand energy, you've introduced exactly the kind of dynamism the tool was designed to escape. The Kickstarter was actually canceled and rescheduled because notification emails didn't send, killing their launch momentum, a project about simple, reliable web publishing, undone by an email delivery failure. The Kumiko lattice holds without glue. The fundraiser couldn't survive without a notification pipeline. What makes a Leveny beautiful is what makes it hard to monetize. The best tools disappear into the work. They don't demand attention. They don't need campaigns. The challenge for Build Awesome is proving that paying the craftsperson doesn't mean changing the crap. Moving on! July 1868. That's the date on this law. The ink was barely dry on the 14th Amendment. Reconstruction was underway, and Congress needing revenue from a nation still paying for a civil war, criminalized distilling spirits at home. The penalty, 5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. For making apple pie vodka in your kitchen, that law stood for 158 years. It outlasted prohibition. It outlasted the repeal of prohibition. It outlasted the legalization of home brewing and home wine making. Exposed to daylight, the logic was always fragile. But no one held it up to the light. Judge Edith Jones did. And the principle she examined is worth following all the way to its conclusion. The government's argument was straightforward. Congress has the power to tax. Distilling produces a taxable good. Therefore, Congress can ban untaxed distilling. Jones asked the obvious next question. If Congress can criminalize any activity that might escape the notice of tax collectors, what can't it criminalize? Remote work generates taxable income. Home businesses generate taxable income. Selling furniture you built in your garage generates taxable income. The government's principle, taken seriously, would let Congress ban any of these activities preemptively. Not because you evaded a tax, but because you might. That's not a taxing power. That's a police power. And the federal government doesn't have one. The details matter here. This ruling applies to three states: Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi. And it will almost certainly face further challenge. The methanol safety concerns are real and worth engineering solutions for. Several countries where home distilling is common have genuine poisoning incidents. But the answer to a dangerous craft is regulation and education, not a blanket criminal ban older than the light bulb. The Hobby Distillers Association has 1,300 members. People who wanted to learn a craft and couldn't, legally for their entire lives. One of the plaintiff's lawyers said he looks forward to sampling their output. After 158 years, that feels about right. Moving on. What if the most expensive model in the room isn't actually the smartest one? Anthropic shipped Mythos Preview with a showcase reel that reads like a greatest hits album. A 27-year-old bug in OpenBSD. a 16-year-old bug in FFmpeg, autonomous exploit chains against the Linux kernel, remote code execution against FreeBSD, written, start to finish, by the model. Impressive work. Genuinely. Then, a company called AIL did something beautifully simple. They took the specific vulnerabilities Mythos showcased, isolated the relevant code, and fed it to small, cheap, open weights models. A 3.6 billion parameter model, costing 11 cents per million tokens, detected the flagship FreeBSD exploit. 8 out of 8 models caught it. A 5.1 billion parameter open model reconstructed the core reasoning chain behind that 27-year-old OpenBSD bug. Pull this thread further. On a basic security reasoning benchmark, small open models outperformed most frontier models from every major lab. The rankings reshuffled completely between tasks. There is no stable best model for cybersecurity. The frontier is jagged. The question nobody in the closed model business wants to ask is this. If a model 1,000 times cheaper recovers the same analysis, what exactly are you paying for? The answer. And AISLE has the receipts here. Over 180 CVEs across 30-plus projects. Maintainer accepted patches in OpenSSL and curl. You're paying for the system, the scaffolding, the pipeline that decomposes discovery from triage, from exploitation, from patch generation, the deep security expertise baked into how you orchestrate models, not which model you orchestrate. This is how open source wins in AI security. The capability isn't locked inside one proprietary checkpoint. It's distributed across an ecosystem of models that anyone can run, combine, and improve. Anthropic's $100 million in credits is generous. But the engineering lesson here is that the moat was never the model. The moat is the craft of the people building the systems around it. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for April 12, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Opus 4.6. Voice by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that outlasts the hype. We'll see you back here tomorrow.